Say, you better bring me a double order of Riti Putis with a little hot sauce on it. That'll just about fix it. Well, here's it. Well, look at Charlie Yardbird
a-rooning. Yes, now how's it going, John?
Oh, everything is mellow, man. Look at this. Get his horn with me.
Yeah,
blow
I got
some?
My horn with me, man. I want to blow some. Yeah. I'm having a little reed trouble.
Haven't got a reed?
Yeah.
Well, Mac Boucher's got a reed.
This is a historic jam session with Slim Gaylord on vocals and Kansas City's own Charlie Parker on sax. You can practically hear the smoke swirling around these guys. I'm totally guilty of romanticizing scenes like this. We found out about this recording during a Charlie Parker show over the summer. We wanted to get to know the real Charlie Parker, and the bebop scholar we spoke with offhandedly told us that we couldn't really explore the history of jazz without talking about drugs. And of course, drugs ravaged the body of Charlie Parker, who died in his 30s, looking like a much older man. There's a popular cultural idea about the relationship between creativity and drugs, an idea some people want to whitewash and others may exaggerate. But what is the complex reality of that relationship? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's the topic of today's Central Standard here on KCUR. We've got Chuck Haddix of KCUR's Fish Fry in the Mars Sound Archive here with us now. Hi, Chuck.
Well, hi, Gina. How are you doing?
Good. How are you? Did you enjoy that music?
I really enjoyed it. And you're absolutely right about being wrapped in smoke. Those guys all smoke Camel Straights.
You know. We're also joined by Jan Shaw, curator of modern art at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Welcome to the show, Jan.
Thanks, Gina. Gina, it's good to see you.
Good to see you, too. And finally, Clancy Martin is here. He's a philosophy professor at UMKC, and he's also a fiction writer of some acclaim. His most recent novel is called Bad Sex, and he's been very open about his past relationship with substance use. Hi, Clancy.
Good morning, Gina. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here. Well, Clancy, before we get into your story, what have various writers from the past had to say about this relationship between the writer's creative process and substances like drugs and alcohol?
Well, it's been a real mix when it comes to writers. Hemingway, as you mentioned in your intro, Hemingway, although he was a notorious alcoholic, he claimed that nobody could write while drinking or write well anyhow, even though he liked to point out that Faulkner would write or claimed that Faulkner would write when drunk. And then the Beats were well known for taking a lot of amphetamines while writing, and Jack Kerouac wrote On the Road, we know, with the help of Benzedrine. Jean-Paul Sartre, the great existentialist and also writer of fiction, was a speed addict. But I honestly think that a mentor of mine, Lars Gustafsson, the great Swedish poet and novelist, got it right when he said that creativity and writing and drugs, that drugs or alcohol are used to treat the same problem that writing is treating in the psyche of the writer. That is to say, it's not so much that drugs or alcohol are helping mostly with the artistic process. I think just the opposite. Rather, that drugs and alcohol may be dealing with a problem that the writer has, and writing is dealing with a problem that the writer has in a different way.
That's really interesting. So it's like the two things are inspired by the same impulse, maybe, and not so much related to one another.
Two different forms of self-medication. That's right.
Wow. That's really interesting. Jan Shaw, are there any great quotes or observations about this bigger question from visual artists before we dive into specific stories and movements?
Well, let's start with a psychoanalyst, Stephen Pesch, who, for instance, said that he sees a lot of artists and they're using drugs to unlock the creativity, to let the images flow, and also as explorations of the self, which is really what any kind of art form is trying to do, is to get out something that's coming from within that's not necessarily what everybody else experiences, or to give voice to something that other people experience but don't know what to say about it or don't know how to interpret it. So I think in any kind of a visual artist context as well, you have artists who are using a large spectrum of kinds of drugs, from everything from caffeine and nicotine to the harder kinds of things, of course, just as a kind of ersatz access to creativity.
Chuck, what would you say? I mean, what do you know about the history of musicians, and particularly jazz musicians, that bear? I mean, Clancy and Jan are actually laying out fairly different pictures of the relationship between creativity and drugs. One idea being that the drugs help you access creativity, and the other being that creativity and drugs are sort of symptoms of the same predisposition in a way. And I'm curious, what do you think when you consider this in the context of the history of jazz? I mean, I'm thinking that the socioeconomic conditions that jazz sprung out of and the physical demands of performing night after night might complicate things.
Yeah, and also it comes back with jazz, it comes back to the environment. You know, the early jazz musicians all worked in bordellos, they worked in clubs. During Prohibition, it was anything goes, in these clubs. So they were surrounded by easy access to drugs. In my biography of Charlie Parker, one of the things that kind of astounded me is how readily drugs were available in Kansas City. There's two different accounts where individuals would take him down to what is now known as Columbus Park, where he would score heroin. Cocaine was readily available, morphine. Everybody smoked reefer. And that goes from the beginning. Louis Armstrong was known to be a viper. And jazz is in the moment, and drugs have a tendency to put us in the moment, not in the past. We're not thinking about the future. We're just thinking about right now. And it's art on the spot. It's art that musicians get together and make this art, and then when they stop, it disappears. It's gone. You know?
So kind of focus, like when you talk about being in the moment, it's also kind of a way of saying to be focused on what you're doing and not in the world of what was happening 10 minutes before or what's going to happen 10 minutes later.
And a lot of these, a lot of it too goes back to lack of health care in a lot of ways. Charlie Parker told this pianist that, he had an ulcer. He had physical issues. His feet bothered him. He had an ulcer. And he said, I go to a doctor, give him $100, and my ulcer's not better. I go to some little guy in a back alley, give him $5 for some heroin, and everything's gone away.
So that really does get back to some of those socioeconomic issues that could be kind of at play here, just the circumstances that the musicians were living in.
Sure, and also, unfortunately, for example, Billie Holiday, Charlie Parker, and so many individuals that had mental issues were self-medicating. And in those days, today we take a very different approach to how we treat substance abuse. Back then, what they would do is lock them up, take away their cabaret cards so they couldn't work. It was more
punitive.
They were more being punished for their issues.
When people who aren't artists of any kind and don't have a lot of personal relationships with artists, musicians, writers, hear stories about creative types and drug use, do you think they make certain assumptions about why that relationship seems to pop up again and again, assumptions that we might want to either dispel or otherwise address?
Well, I think people do look askance at creative individuals who they learn about who are having problems with or who are using something, using other substances. And yet, I think people are a little too judgmental about that because there's such a spectrum of things that people medicate with. Everybody, almost everybody, will take a cup of coffee in the morning, cups of coffee during the day. That's just a steady feed of caffeine. What happens when you stop coffee? Withdrawal. It's not a different...
And you may not perform very well in your job.
That's right. I mean, all of those kinds of things. So it's a little bit of a finger-pointing thing, which I think is kind of sad.
Yeah, what would you say about that, Chuck? Assumptions that people make and about this relationship?
Well, what I find interesting is when you watch the evening news, what do you see? Ads for drugs. I mean, in the drug industry is a big industry. We are a self-medicated nation as a whole. And that's perfectly okay. But if somebody's smoking pot, it's a whole different thing. But that's all changing, of course. I think what we're seeing is a lot like the acceptance of gay marriage, with all these states now legalizing marijuana and actually talking about medical marijuana. You know, the government suppressed any research into the benefits of marijuana, you know, epilepsy, treating children for epilepsy. This is a new field. And I think what we're seeing is a turning point in our attitude towards drugs in this country. And you can see it coming down with them letting a lot of drug offenders out of nonviolent drug offenders out of prison. You know,
as Jan was saying, there's such a spectrum, though. I mean, granted, moralizing is probably not helpful no matter what, but there are cases where you could look at it and be like, this is recreational, this is harmless, this is an exploration of the self. But then you do see circumstances, you see stories like Charlie Parker's, where a young man's body is totally ravaged by the time he's in his late 30s. And so that's sort of a tricky thing to find your way through.
You know, there's an interesting autobiography called Man-Child in the Promised Land by a guy named Claude Brown, and it's quite a portrait of Harlem. And they talk about the heroin plague. And for years, individuals had been told how harmful marijuana was. And people have been smoking pot for, you know, since we've been around. And they've been lied to about that. And so when heroin came along, they didn't realize how damaging it was. They thought just another drug like marijuana, which was not addicting. I mean, it can be habit forming, but it's not addicting. And then heroin came along, and it was a whole other story because it's highly addicting, you know. And smoking of opium going on too in the 20s and 30s. As far as jazz is concerned, there's a lot of anthologies we have in the Mars Sound Archive with reefer songs, songs about opiates that go back into the 20s from the beginning of recorded sound. People have put coded language into songs referencing marijuana. Think about kicking the gong around, you know. Minnie the Moocher, she was low-down hoochie-coocher. You went to Chinatown, kicked the gong around. Yeah, it's a reference to opium. She's smoking opium. And her boyfriend
was coping. And this is like before the 60s. I mean, I think that's maybe an assumption that people make, is that this is something that started in fairly recent decades.
That goes way back. I mean, if we really want to think about the role of any kind of drug, let's call it for lack of a better term, think about the ancient cultures of shamanistic belief and people having visions. For instance, in the Maya culture, it was chocolate, pure chocolate. In the Inca culture, it was coca leaves. And in the North Mexican people, the Huichol, it was peyote. And those were people who were having visions. In the North American Native Americans, it was tobacco. So all of those spectrums, why were people doing that? Because it was an access to some kind of another plane of existence, another plane of understanding and consciousness.
Well, Jan Shaw, what is our earliest knowledge of how drugs and artists interacted? And we're not just talking about what we currently would think of as drugs and illegal drugs. We can include, caffeine, alcohol, any substance that alters your mind.
I think where we really start to see talk about it, and it becomes almost a cultural thing, was absinthe. And the 19th century artists, especially the late 19th century artists, hanging out in cafes and drinking absinthe,
Where are we talking about? I'm picturing
Paris.
Talking
about Paris. But it wasn't just there, but that was really the cafe culture center. And absinthe, of course, is derived from wormwood, and it's a poison, really, but it had hallucinogenic effects, and it loosened people up. And so we know that Degas and Gauguin and Van Gogh and Lautrec and Manet and Picasso.
The people of field trips.
Pardon?
You know, these are the guys you go on field trips to see
exactly.
Their artwork when you're in fourth
grade. Exactly. So they enjoyed that. That was the cafe scene.
What do you know about how the effects of absinthe may relate to their paintings, to the works that you see them creating?
That's a question, because I don't know that they were necessarily drinking absinthe while painting. So it was more of a kind of loosening up, a kind of activity, a cultural connection thing. And whether it affected their art, I don't know. You know, people used to say about cubism in general, oh, what were they on? Oh my gosh, all of these shattered forms. What were they doing? Well, that was in fact science. They were responding to the space-time theories on a kind of generalized level of high science, very sophisticated science. So
yeah, objectivity has just kind of died at this moment.
Yeah, so it wasn't about that at all. I don't think it filtered into their work very much at that point.
In New Orleans, you've got the old Absence House, you know, and in the early days, that's what they served, you know, and it's still there. I think it's on Bourbon Street, if memory serves, and it shows how popular it was.
Yeah, Clancy, I mean, what do you think when you hear this? Just the idea of socializing, the way that artists socialize, maybe being largely what this is about more than the work itself.
Well, you know, several interesting questions, and they're not necessarily causally related, which is where I think sometimes we tend to get a little bit confused. It's certainly the case that artists are the sort of people who already, by their nature, originality is a criterion we generally talk about when it comes to good art. Being outside of kind of the ordinary bourgeois culture, where drugs were always very much outside of the ordinary, well, with the exception of alcohol, outside of the ordinary bourgeois culture. Also, the association with youth and this boredom and the attempt to treat boredom in all these different ways. When we think about, for example, how many lives of actors and comedians have been destroyed by drugs, we don't say that there's a causal relationship between their genius as actors and their drug consumption. In fact, we tend to say just the opposite, that their performances tend progressively to be destroyed by their drug habits. So I do think we should be careful about the causal
effect.
Yeah, exactly. Now, whether or not drugs can expand one's mind, it seems to me, at least, non-controversial that drugs can both expand your mind, expand your ability to perceive, can put you in the moment, as we were talking about before. Also can greatly, depending upon the particular drug, can greatly increase your work productivity, at least for a time. When we look at our most enduring artists whose careers aren't very brief, we tend to see a kind of maturation of their work over time that, in fact, as a rule, particularly among writers, I suppose, although I can't speak for musicians and painters because I don't know as much about their work, but for writers, they increasingly go away from their early drug experiences, and they may find, as Chuck was pointing out, the famous case of David Foster Wallace, when David Foster Wallace found that he could no longer produce because of the number of legally produced drugs that he was consuming. And it was when he decided, okay, these medications are interfering with my creative process too much, that unfortunately he fell back into a terrible depression and committed suicide. But so I think that there are several things we're talking about. One is being young and being outside of society, breaking the rules of society, escaping boredom. And a lot of great art is produced in this certain, you know, between the ages roughly of, say, 20 and 35. And that's when one tends to be in a real kind of exploratory mode where you might consume a lot of drugs, maybe even in part just because they're illegal or because they break boredom or because they're fun or because they stimulate the social life of the moment. Then there are these questions, which may or may not be related, of how the drugs are either influencing your art or, as I've suggested, perhaps treating the same anxiety that is leading to the artistic impulse, or the same
quite questioning.
A lot, you know, when we look at, for example, the mind of Leonardo da Vinci, he was hallucinating on his own report in his journals, what we would call hallucinating almost constantly. He'd look at a wall and he'd just see, he'd see an entire battlefield on the wall. His mind would produce these images. This is not because he was taking mescaline. This is just the mind of Leonardo da Vinci. Now, whether perhaps lesser artists might be able to tap into the same thing through the use of drugs, it seems to me that many of them have, at least for a time.
Jan, can you talk to me about the case of Jean-Michel Basquiat? That's getting a lot more contemporary.
Yes, interesting one.
That's a big jump to the contemporary world. And Jean-Michel Basquiat was a kid in New York who was a graffiti artist. And his graffiti stood out among, it wasn't just, you know, the usual graffiti. It was extraordinary, expansive drawings, you know, paintings on walls. And it was, people began to notice it. It stood out. We walk by graffiti all the time and just don't pay attention, but this was amazing. And eventually, you know, sort of picked up by the studios and painting, given, you know, materials, having given them the money to for the painting, materials that he needed, and became an extremely well-known, high-priced artist in the galleries. But unfortunately, he was a heroin addict, and he passed away very young.
What do we know about how heroin came into his life?
Well, when you live on the streets, when you're a kid in, you know, growing up in a bad part of town, let's say, of New York City, those things are out there.
In the 80s or 70s, it really would have been when he was 80, growing up.
70s, early and 80s especially, though. That's when he really kind of hit that mark. But those things are just available. They're just available. And I don't know exactly how or when it all began for him, but it escalated, and as we all know, heroin is one of the worst. And so once you're addicted, that's it, and you just overdosed.
What do you think it would be important to notice about a case like his and to understand about the relationship in his case?
Well, for one thing, I don't think that the heroin made him paint like he painted. I don't think that. I don't know for sure what he might have been doing while painting. But it was that expression, as Clancy's already pointed out, this idea of just this opening up and even the freedom to go out into the city and just mark it and paint on it and make the city yours in some way and make it so public. I don't really know exactly. I don't think anyone knows exactly what he was doing when he was doing that or anything of that sort. But it certainly does have a bearing on the idea of a lack of inhibition and a sense of empowerment and a sense of freedom.
Do you think that hearing stories like all of the stories we've heard so far today are part of a narrative that influences young artists, musicians, writers, as they begin to think about what does it look like to be a writer? What does it look like to be an artist?
I would say yes.
Absolutely, without question. I mean, I know when people used to ask me, how did you become an alcoholic? I would say, well, honestly, my dad used to say, well, I was born an alcoholic, but it took me years of practice to get really good at it. And there is something to that view also. But if you are raised on a diet of on an intellectual diet of Bukowski and Hemingway and Richard Yates and these very and John Berryman and these famous alcoholics whose art was alternating, generally speaking, with their alcoholism, naturally you're going to be romanticizing this in your mind and the view of yourself as this falling down drunk who is also producing her his art is a glamorous view. And that this is how one becomes, of course, an addict of any kind, is just repeated abuse of the same substance over and over again and justifying yourself to the abuse of that substance. So I do think we have to be careful. I think you're right that we have a tendency to romanticize these things at our peril and at the peril of other young people who are currently artists or are trying to cultivate their art. But also, it's very important, I think, to point out what Jan pointed out, which is that the stigmatization of these behaviors is just as dangerous as the glamorization of them or the romanticization of them. When we stigmatize them, we don't help at all with people who are going, and as a matter of fact, we create the circumstance which promotes an attitude of rebelliousness, promotes an attitude
of
romanticization.
Yeah, that this is an outsider behavior.
Exactly. Yeah. This is an outsider behavior.
Chuck, you wanted to jump in?
Well, you know, in the case of Charlie Parker, you know, young musicians who followed him to jam sessions and followed him from club to club, their thing was, if you want to play like Bird, you got to be like Bird. And he was very careful to tell them, don't do this. Stay away from this stuff. But they ignored his advice, and subsequent generations became heroin addicts, and it was really a plague in the 1940s and 50s.
And it didn't turn them into birds.
No.
I'm Gina Kaufman. KCUR Central Standard will return with with Charlie Parker's story and Clancy Martin's. This is a conversation about creativity and mind-altering substances. Stay with us. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show was inspired by a conversation about bebop. We were told during that discussion that we couldn't really talk about the history of jazz without talking about the history of drugs. We thought it was an interesting comment, especially if we applied it to the arts more broadly. So today, we're talking about the complex relationship between creativity and drugs. Our guests are curator Jan Schall, writer Clancy Martin, and music man Chuck Haddix of KCUR's Fish Fry. And Chuck, what were we just listening to?
We were just listening to Minnie the Moocher, 1931, Cab Calloway. There's a lot of irony there. Cab Calloway really established his career by singing these songs about drugs. And then later on, when the beboppers were doing heroin, he was very critical of them and very down on them, and came out publicly about, you know, these young people doing drugs, when that was how he established his career.
Right before we went to break, you were talking about how there was this mindset that to play like Bird, you had to be like Bird, and that Charlie Parker had a little bit different take. He was kind of warning people against following his example, especially in terms of his drug use.
Yeah, he warned Hampton Hawes and Frank Morgan both talk about this, about, you know, everyone knew that Charlie was a heroin addict, all the musicians did. And he warned, he would tell them, he would say, you know, you don't want to mess with this. Chet Baker and he were playing on the West Coast, and these drug dealers would follow Charlie around, and he told Chet Baker, he said, stay away from these guys. You don't want to go there with this. But Chet, of course, ignored the warning, and it came at a great cost. He, tragic figure, died too young too.
How did drugs fit into the larger story of the birth and evolution of jazz?
Well, it was there from the beginning. I mean, if you think about it, if you look at the old pictures, everybody's drinking, and they're drinking whiskey. They're smoking cigarettes. Louis Armstrong was a well-known viper. He used to carry his reefer in his napkin, and it's kind of funny, his handkerchief. It's kind of funny because Dexter Gordon talked about how Louis was always bragging about his good old New Orleans marijuana when it was just dirt weed. It was terrible stuff, and Dexter was smoking better stuff. And it was always there, cocaine. If you look at Storyville here in Kansas City, it was readily available, and morphine, it was all there, and they were surrounded by it. Bird started smoking reefers when he was about 14 years old, and was hanging out the club. He used to like to roost in the Reno Club, the balcony above the bandstand, where the marijuana smoke was heavy from the Basie band smoking pot on the stand. I mean, you know, in Kansas City's not atypical in that. All your jazz capitals, New Orleans, Chicago, and New York, were rife with drug use and availability.
How do you look at this as someone who is sort of this, I don't know, this master of music history? I mean, and of pop culture history in some ways. I'm just curious, I mean, do you view it as sort of a complicated thing, just a fact of life during these time periods, as something that might have potentially robbed us of years of music from some of these people, or is it just a case-by-case kind of basis?
I think it's a case-by-case kind of basis, really. You think about, those that kick survived, like Miles Davis. He locked himself in a room and kicked. He beat up John Coltrane because John Coltrane was using. And it's always part of jazz culture, but it's also part of our culture in general. It's just kind of been swept under the rug a little bit. When they did the film Kansas City, when Frank Barhart and Altman did Kansas City, they modeled that woman, society woman, who was a laudanum addict, after somebody that they knew.
What is laudanum?
Laudanum is a form of opium. You would drink it.
Mixed with alcohol.
Yeah. It's very, very potent. And it think about Samuel Taylor Coleridge when he wrote Kubla Khan. He was doing laudanum, and he was in a dreamlike state, and the poem came to him. His subconscious really wrote it. Edgar Allan Poe also used laudanum. It was quite readily available and widely used in this country and around the world.
Sorry, I distracted you from your story about the filming of Kansas City, the movie.
Well, the movie Kansas City, there's a society woman who's a laudanum addict. And Frank Barhyte modeled her after someone he knew here in Kansas City, a society woman who was an addict. Unfortunately for the musicians, there was no Betty Ford Clinic. They got thrown in jail. They didn't get treatment.
And people are fascinated by their stories as it is, so maybe we just know about their either struggles or recreational experiences, however you want to see them, in a way we don't know about those with other people.
That's correct.
Clancy, for you, could you tell me your story, how substances and writing kind of were an equal part of your past?
Well, sure. When I first started writing, I still owned a chain of luxury jewelry stores in Dallas-Fort Worth, and I also owned a wine bar at that time. And so I had wonderful wine at home. And I would come home from work at around 6 or 7, and I'd sit down and I'd take a mild form of speed called Didrex. It's just a weight loss drug, basically, that was available by prescription. And I'd drink a bottle of Tour wine, and I would write usually 3 or 4, maybe as many as 10 short stories a night, every night, 5, 7 days a week. I wrote hundreds of stories during that first year of my story production. Now, only a couple of them were any good, but those were my first few published stories, and the core of what became my first novel emerged out of that time. But I found over the course of time that I fell into this sort of pattern, established fiction writing pattern that, you know, was also the pattern Hemingway fell into, and Bukowski when it came to his fiction, although he wrote a lot of his poetry when he was drunk, and I think you can tell the difference between the drunk poems and the sober poems. Dennis Johnson, similar pattern.
What is the pattern?
Drinking at night when you're not writing, and then waking up early in the morning, normally with a blistering hangover, and managing to get about 5 hours of writing done before maybe resuming drinking. And for a long time, I thought there is a funny kind of clarity that you have that I'm sure probably everyone at the table has experienced. When you have a really severe hangover, your brain works in a slightly different way than it does during ordinary thought. And for a long time, I thought that a hangover was really kind of crucial to my writing experience. I no longer believe that to be the case, although it does. I don't think it should be trivialized either. It definitely was relevant to my creative experience at the time. But then when I got sober, a lot of what friends of mine who are writers consider to be my best work, honestly, is all post-sobriety writing. So, which is not to say that I'm not wrestling with the same difficulties that I was wrestling with when I was self-medicating with alcohol, and experiencing the same kind of liberation when I'm writing that I did when I was either drinking or writing when I was still drinking. It's rather just to say that I do subscribe to this view, I think, that people who produce a lot of art are producing art and possibly taking drugs for the same reason and experiencing similar kinds of escape. And when they don't, I just had an interview with this fellow, Jason Stanley, a great Yale philosopher and one of the best young philosophers in the country. And he said, when he doesn't write a book, about a year, 2 years go by, he gets increasingly mopey, increasingly depressed, increasingly anxious, and finally his family can't take it anymore, his wife and his child, and they say, go write a book so you can be a sane, normal person again. And there's some kind of discharge of neurotic energy that writing accomplishes. And I don't know if the same is true for the other arts or not, but that's my experience.
Well, so I'm interested in the story you told earlier about David Foster Wallace. If there is this idea that there is either mental illness or some kind of torment going on in the inner life of a writer, or maybe another kind of artist too, that is partly tied up with this. I mean, that to me is both a sad idea. I mean, I guess the idea that that an artist might have to choose between happiness and a healthy life and that creative output. I mean, my personal experience is that the happier I am, the more productive I am. Like that any kind of mental anguish produces just kind of a distraction and a paralysis. But it sounds like for a lot of people, maybe some other version of events is the case. And I hate the idea that someone would be at least believing that they're faced with that choice of creativity or happiness.
Or they might not have that choice, right? They might simply find themselves in the situation where their psyche is such that in order to be happy, they have to be productive. And that when they're not productive, when they're not writing, or when they're not producing their art, they find themselves slipping into this, into these stages of depression or anxiety. And it may also be the case, and I believe this to be true, that there's more than one solution to this, to the problem of psychological suffering, which every human being is confronted with. I remember there's a great lama by the name of Jingyame Kinsei Rinpoche, who was once asked, what is the role of marijuana and alcohol in artistic creativity? And he was quiet for a moment, and then he said, absolutely useless. And I think the reason he considered it to be absolutely useless is he thought that, well, we need to address the problem of neuroses, of anxiety, of mental suffering more directly, rather than distracting ourselves from the problem. And I do think that might be part of the reason that particularly for artists who have these great spans of creativity when they're very young and then it comes to some kind of abrupt or tragic end, we make this connection between drugs and creativity. If you look at, you know, our Dostoevskys, our Tolstoys, the careers that span many, many years, my friend Jonathan Franzen, there's simply no connection between the drugs and the creativity there.
In the long lives of artists.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think the 600-pound gorilla in the room is antidepressants. You know, we take antidepressants to make ourselves feel good, and often if you don't get therapy that accompanies it, the problem doesn't go away. It's just masked. And then when if you've ever seen anybody come off of antidepressants, it's not a pretty sight. It's very difficult to kick it. I think that's a major problem in our society. You know, I'm not a creative writer. I write histories. But I find that I do my best writing when my subconscious takes over. And I'm not even consciously thinking about what I'm doing. I'm just, everything falls away but the page. And that's when I'm my most productive and my most creative.
I think that that would be true of any kind of creative endeavor, whether you're writing a dissertation or a book or making art or music. Is that sense of the flow, of being in the flow, and where it seems like it's not even coming from you, that it's coming from somewhere else, and it's just flowing through you. You are the vehicle through which it's coming. And it may be in whatever art form, or even, you know, writing a very factual kind of thing, but you get in this flow, and that's an incredible high in itself. But what we're all talking about here a little bit is psychology, and maybe we should talk about Freud.
Yeah, I think we should talk about Freud. I think we should talk about surrealism. I think we should return to a lot of things that have already come up. But KCUR's Central Standard is off to one last break. I'm Gina Kaufman. More from our conversation across artistic disciplines about creativity and drugs when we return. Don't go away and enjoy Bob Dylan.
Though I know that evening's empire has returned into sand, vanished from my hand, left me blindly here to stand, but still not sleeping. My weariness amazes is me, I am branded on my feet. I have no one to meet, and the ancient empty streets too dead for dreaming. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going
to... Oh, poor Bob Dylan, he's not sleeping. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with writer Clancy Martin, who is now sober, but whose creative process used to be tied up in alcohol and some drugs, and modern art curator Jan Schall from the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, as well as KCUR's Chuck Haddix. He hosts The Fish Fry, and he runs the Mar Sound Archive at UMKC. We've mentioned a few things that we want to get to before we go today, and so let's think about some of those. Jan, right before break, you mentioned Freud, that we should talk about Freud. Why?
Because Freud was the founder of what we today think about as psychology, psychoanalysis, all of those things. The idea that we don't just live on this literal plane of our daily lives, that we have dreams, we have visions, our minds are working in other ways. And so once we recognize that and it's out there in a kind of scientific context.
We create our own realities
we
in
do,
some way.
We do. But once it's out there, this notion that there are many levels of mind, then you can talk about those different things and what kinds of drugs are used to treat various kinds of maladies of the mind and which are become recreational in a sense. And so the use of drugs then And even the use of dreams. And I want to talk about surrealism.
Yeah, please
because,
do.
Because the surrealists were the artist group, visual artist group, that was very affected by Freud's ideas about dreams and hallucinogen. And so they recorded their dreams and they sought, once they had really understood what this was about, or even sort of understood what it was about, they sought to bring that surrealité, that higher reality, to their art, and they put themselves in interesting situations. They did hypnosis. They recorded their dreams. They painted their dreams. They tried all kinds of things that would access this higher reality. And the only one who didn't really do anything was, ironically, Salvador Dali, who everyone would look at and say, "Well, he was clearly on something." But in fact,
melting clocks.
Exactly, and he said, "I am drugs."
Yeah, well, that's interesting. The idea that that the creative mind might be its own fuel, that the idea that you need some external source of vision and access to that like subconscious state that, yeah, Salvador Dali needed no help.
That's right.
Chuck, you wanted to talk about the 60s.
Well, you know, just thinking about it, if ever there was a time when drugs shall we say, inspired across a wide variety of art, it was the 1960s. You know, you had the whole generation of love starting in 1967 where people were experimenting with LSD, peyote, mescaline, smoking pot, beginning to do amphetamines. But the focus there was expanding your consciousness. That was the catchword. And if you think about the music, the art, and the literature of the time, too, with Ken Kesey and the electric Kool-Aid acid test. It just permeated our society during that time, and we were in unknown territory. We didn't know where it would take us. More so, you know, today, of course, the drugs are different. They're designer drugs, usually. What variation on MDA or something like that, you know, the party drugs that they do. But during the 60s, it was expand your consciousness, and it was a given that if you wanted to expand your consciousness, you would do LSD or some other psychedelic, and, you know, the psychedelic era.
How do you think that, I mean, can you give an example of an artist or musician who you think, like, their career is in some way defined by that?
I think Jimi Hendrix, more so than anyone else. You know, Purple Haze. In fact, there's a brand of acid named after one of his songs.
Yeah, Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison both are classic cases of no one here gets out alive, you know, the book that no one should read, at least not at too young an age, that my big brother gave me when I was 8.
Oh, good.
Aldous Huxley and his enormous influence on the generation of the 60s. And these
talk about Aldous Huxley and his influence.
Well, you know... And these studies, to be fair, are going on. There's a huge resurgence in the research on psychotropic substances going on today and their relationship with creativity. And they were stigmatized for a long time, which Jan helpfully pointed out is definitely doesn't contribute to our understanding of creativity. And agreeing with Chuck that this sort of era of social experimentation by the youth, not only of drugs in the 60s, but also a sexual exploration of other religions, mythological exploration of the subconscious, all kinds of attempts to expand the consciousness, also resulted in this wonderful period of flourishing of American art, particularly of American music, but in literature and the visual arts as well. And Aldous Huxley was one of the people whose early experimentations with very high doses of LSD and his famous book, The Doors of Perception, where the doors got their name, showing us that there is more to the brain than ordinary reality. Now, whether we find sources of inspiration in these things, which we can, and they can be accessed in a variety of ways, and that question seems clearly, yes, we can find sources of inspiration in these things. On the other hand, whether ongoing artistic production will be supported, bolstered, or ultimately interfered with through the consumption of these kinds of substances, separate question.
And yeah, can you flesh that out a little bit more from your own experience? Because you talked about how early on you had a very productive relationship between your consumption of, it sounds like, alcohol and speed.
Yeah, alcohol, speed, and cocaine
writing.
When I was young, which
but
I do not recommend to anyone, especially not my students. You know, when I was growing up in Calgary, you could get acid, walk down to the Stephen Avenue Mall. I remember the first time I took LSD, I was in fourth grade. I think about that now.
Whoa.
With an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old. Yeah. First time I ever took Purple Mike was fourth grade. By the time I was 16 or so, I just couldn't even do acid anymore because I'd done it so many times. And this was the great poetry writing phase of my life before I turned to more narrative fiction. I think that the artists who make it into their 30s and continue to be productive, as a rule, when I look at the writers, and I don't know if this is also true for the musicians and visual artists, but they tend to have some kind of point at which they're like, okay, this is destroying my body, this is destroying my brain, this is destroying my ability to create. And then they either make the transition where they continue to be productive artists without these substances, or you know, that's it. That's the end of their careers. But as a rule, it seems to me, if they survive, you know, if they make it past that magic age or that disastrous age of 27, it doesn't seem to me, like when we look at the case of Philip Seymour Hoffman, for example, Philip Seymour Hoffman did not die of a heroin overdose because he was using heroin to make himself a better actor. Philip Seymour Hoffman was a great actor because he was the kind of a guy who needed heroin to get through the day and was in this constant ongoing battle with that substance.
Interesting. How has your creative life been different since you've been sober?
Well, it has taken more self-discipline. I will say that. It has changed in that I have to have a much more rigid schedule in order to guarantee my productivity. Then it isn't like sitting down at the computer and words are just flowing out of me like they were when I was using Bordeaux and Didrex to write my short stories.
But you found another technique.
Yeah. The early morning is a very, very good technique for being close to your subconscious, as Chuck was saying, being close to your dreams, as Jan was saying. I think that's when you can get into the flow, into the moment. Early morning.
Our time is up for today's conversation on KCUR's Central Standard, but we'll leave it there with that advice to try the early morning. Clancy Martin, thanks for sharing your story.
Thanks so much for having us on, Gina.
Jan Schall of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. It's been a fascinating look into the intoxicants of art history. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
And Chuck Haddix of the Fish Fry. It's always fun to have you here. Thanks so much for stopping by on a weekday of all times.
Well, thanks for having us.
You can listen back to this conversation and share it with your friends at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it ready for you by the end of the day. Tomorrow, as we gear up for the World Series, I will trash talk New York, the whole city, with WNYC's Brian Lehr, and I will crush him. So tune in, listen to that tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date coming up next on KCUR.